أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. الحمد لله, we are starting our Q&A session here for this first Muharram Ashura. As we promised that Maulana Asad Jafri is live with us, we'd like to thank him for joining us live for this program. And I'm sure, like myself, most of you are looking forward to this very important program. Alhamdulillah, Maulana have selected an amazing topic, which is so relevant, so important. And after discussing with all of you after each program, I got the idea that how important it is for all of us, actually. And that we can see those in the questions we are getting. We're getting so many questions tonight. And Maulana has to finish by 7 o'clock. So we'll try to get as many questions as possible. And if you will miss this, and if you have significant questions, inshallah, maybe we can have another program if Maulana has some time for us later during the month, inshallah. With that, we'd like to start the program. I'd like to request Maulana, please come and start the program with a loud salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Thank you, Mutarhaba. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa bihi nasta'in. Wa huwa khayrun nasirin wa mu'in. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.
First of all, we are thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the past 12 nights, and I pray Allah accepts your grief, accepts your gham, accepts your service towards the Ahlul Bayt, and of course towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. MashaAllah, the questions are rolling in, and they are beautiful questions. So I had planned initially to speak for about 15-20 minutes, but I think that what we'll do is we'll just get into the questions if that's okay, to maximize our time. I will say this, that the purpose of the Ashura was simply to address those issues that I think are right now entrenched inside our young generation. Obviously, I didn't cover everything. Obviously, I didn't cover, many things that are there. But I did try to, and this is all based on me talking to the youth, serving the youth. When I see myself, those things that are kind of common through every generation. And so I know that many of you might have liked if I touched this topic or that topic. Or keep in mind, we only have 12 nights, right? And there are a plethora of issues that our youth face today. So it was my discretion. Inshallah, hopefully you find it beneficial. I know I did. I learned a lot myself. The second point is, I'm not sure if that sound that you hear is coming into the audio, but my neighbor is doing some work. And so he has he's got some sort of a water tap on. So I hopefully this mic is drowning that out. I'm not sure if it is or not.
We are good, Marna.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. So, that was number one. The second point I want to make, and then we'll get to the questions, is that, this was meant to talk to the youth directly and to challenge them, okay? And to ask them to, like I said many times throughout the Ashura, to seek the religion. It's there, ready to be sought. Now seek it, right? If you want to know anything else, you research it and research it and research it, but that has to come from passion, okay? Now, my parents in the audience who are listening, of course, we are very worried about our children. I'm worried about my kids. You're worried about your kids. And it's not just us. You look at, for example, the holy prophets. Nabi Nuh, now the adab is coming. He's looking for his son. This is my son. This is my son. Allah says, Ya Nuhu laysa min ahlik. He is not your son. He's not from your ahl. He's chosen his path. And that's his destiny. Or you have Nabi Ibrahim, right? رَبِّ جَعَلْنِي مُقِيمَ الصَّلَاةَ مِنْ ذُرِّيَّةِ رَبَّنَا وَتَقَبَّلْ دُعَى. That, oh Allah, make me amongst the ones who prays to Allah, establishes prayer, and my ذُرِّيَّةِ, and my children as well. So these are prophets that were worried about their children. Imam Ali's letter that I talked about in Rajab with all of you, letter number 31 on Nahj al-Balagha, talks about the idea. He gives paragraph upon paragraph of advice to his son. And this is a ma'asum son, obviously a father to a son, that he's worried about what will happen to you in a couple of years. So, it's a reality that will be there. to my elders, your parents are worried about you. You are worried about your kids. Your kids will be worried about your grandkids. It's just how it is. Inshallah, I'll get through some of the questions and then we'll go from there. So let's begin with these questions bit by bit and see how far we get. They keep rolling in. So I will answer them as they come in. So the first one is that my son is in his mid-20s and has mostly Sunni friends. He says that he does not feel any special connection with Muharram and the Shia traditions of Azadari. As a Shia mother, it is very painful for me and I don't know how to handle this situation. We took him to madrasas, he read Nohas, the question says, but now he says it doesn't make sense to him. Please advise. You know, it's a common issue, and it's only a common issue because our youngsters and our youth see Azadari as a series of rituals. And they believe these rituals now date back to some Indian Pakistani culture. They don't understand that a lot of what our majalis looks like actually comes from the Ahlul Bayt. They taught us how to grieve. Yes, there are certain things that the culture has influenced that sometimes can be seen as detrimental. But to throw out the entire azah because of a few rituals that may not make sense to you, I think is a cop-out. And I am okay with calling out the youth. And hopefully if there are individuals right now sitting there, my young guys right now sitting there, and you have 1,000 questions about tabuts and alums and this and that, and there is a question about the alums that I'll get to, this and that, and why do we do this? It's so weird. You know, there's a white sheet and there's red paint all over it. You guys surprise me sometimes. Everything else, inshallah, I'll get to it. Everything else makes sense to you. This, for some reason, is a sore spot. And part of it is because I think you have some trauma. There is a little bit of azadari trauma. You know, you can't wear a certain color. You can't sit a certain way. You can't eat a certain food. You can't watch television. So growing up, Muharram was always this sort of pit in your stomach, gloomy. You know, the lights are out, the beating of the chest. You watched your mother and your father cry like you've never seen them cry before. You watched the alim scream on the minbar. So it's possible that your connection to azadari comes from a very traumatic experience. So let's deal with that first. Don't throw the entire azah out. If things don't make sense to you, ask Baba, ask, why do we do this? Why do we do that? And if there are some things that don't have any religious basis, and yes, there are some things that are, let's say, Hindu culture, for example, or I don't know, other culture, for example, then stop and ask yourself, is this worth the fight? Is this really detrimental towards the deen? Now, yeah, if there is stuff that's blasphemous, they're making up stories, there is, you know, all sorts of corrupted and made up and jaili things that are distorted, that's different. And yeah, sometimes in the history of the azah, in this azadari, there has been things that have no basis and should be removed. But for someone to say, I don't have any connection, here's a man with his family and friends standing up for justice, sacrificing everything he could, treating his enemies with the utmost respect, giving his horses, the enemy's horses, water, the compassion Hussein showed, the love Hussein showed, the respect for God Hussein showed, the fight and courage and bravery he showed. Don't get stuck on rituals. If that doesn't make sense to you, fine. Look at the overall message. These are universal messages that humanity now is drawn towards. Right? So don't reduce the azah to a set of rituals, the color of your shirt, for example. I don't know, something you're wearing on your wrist or around your neck, for example. A certain food you can only eat on the day of Ashura. You know, you're doing yourself a disservice. You're doing the azah a disservice. You're missing out. I'm sorry. I have no problem with you having non-Shia friends. You're missing out on a path of revolution, a path of a salvation. To my moms out there, to my dads out there, you've done your level best. I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, do this, do that. No. Raising your child when they were, let's say, 10, 11 years old, the options to take a child to an English madrasa were very, very limited. I've seen the Beit al-Asr community. I've seen the Beit al-Qa'im community. You know, you are fighting this urge now, even though, you know, an Urdu majlis is nothing like an English majlis. It's far better. You know, there is, you know, just sheer language sometimes. and you feel connected to the alim who talks in Urdu. You feel more grief when the masahib is in Urdu. But even that, you sacrifice all of that to listen to someone like me just for the sake of your children. Now, if that kid does not have a connection, all you can do at the age of 20 now, mid-20s, 25, 27, he's not a child, right? He's a grown man. All you can say is, look, if you have questions, ask this person, ask that person. Don't settle. Say, oh, you know, throw the entire Azza out, right? Let's be a little bit careful with that, okay? So as a mother, what can you do? You've done everything you can do. All you can do is remind them, look, for everything there's an answer. If you are serious about this, seek the answer. If you have azadari trauma and there is triggers inside of you, that every time now muharram is announced, there's a pit in your stomach, then you have to handle that. Deal with that. Go back and revisit yourself and have that uncomfortable conversation, inshallah. Question number two. Ma spoke about drug use amongst the youth of our community. Before we can address the difficult task of handling the youth on this issue, I feel that the low-hanging fruit to be addressed initially should be the adults. There's an environment of total denial with regards to both drugs and zina problems. Both the community and religious leaders are shy away from these topics as they find them uncomfortable. I would like to know what is Mana's recommendation on how best to impress the community, adults, and these issues should be openly addressed and look for common solutions. Okay, so, you know, I get it. You're right. You know, as I've mentioned a few times in the Ashura, if a young person has uncultivated land, as Imam Ali says, the cultivators of that land are not just one, there are several. Okay, the most effective two cultivators are the kid themselves and the parents. Okay, and I agree with the person who asked the question. There is this denial. There is this kind of, you know, let me bury my head in the sand. This not my kid, not my kid, not my kid. And, you know, unfortunately, if you are a parent like that, who does not take this seriously, then unfortunately, you're going to wake up one day to a rude awakening. And I don't mean to be negative, but I've seen it too many times. And all the signs are there. All the signs are there. And I think sometimes we are somebody, you know, we kind of take, we are a little bit of a, we have a fear of shame in our community. If I come to an alim or come to a senior in my community and say, look, I need help in raising my children. My child is having drug issues. My child is with a lot of women, let's say, for example. We're worried about the fact that the person in front of me might judge me and say, oh, you're a horrible parent. You know, gharko samalo, look after your house. So in order for me to avoid that awkwardness, I'll kind of turn a blind eye. You're doing nobody a service by doing that. Okay? So if you see the signs, okay, he's out a lot, for example, right? Rebellious in nature, okay? Money for some reason is being spent like crazy, okay? He seems to be over-hungry. He seems to be delirious. He seems to be a little bit out of it. Stop and ask yourself, is there a problem? Okay, he'll deny it, she'll deny it. But we have to be able now to understand. Now, as far as the idea that the ulama don't talk about this, I completely disagree. If you are looking for these topics like zina to be talked about on the member, then that's not correct. Everything has a time and place for it. In that environment where there is the awam and the public, there's an 8-year-old and an 88-year-old in that majma, then of course not. You're not going to talk about these issues. You have to arrange a little bit of a different programming, targeted at a different audience to really pinpoint the problem. Okay? This, you know, sometimes this absurd discussion that everything needs to be addressed on the minbar is not accurate. It's not wise. Even the prophets had levels of ashab, levels of discussion. He had the awam, he had the sir. He had the common companions and common discussions, and he had those that were kind of secretive within his circles. Okay? So, you know, as speakers, we do our level best to talk about those topics that are current, that are relevant. We're bound to upset somebody. You know, if there's hundreds of people watching, for example, my speech, I won't please everybody, for sure. And that's why it's easier to please God than to please others. Number three, question from a young youth. Can you give some practical tips on how to kill your ego so you can travel to God? Great question. So obviously there's worship, right? Salat, namaz does a lot of things. We underestimate the power of salat. Okay, we really, really do. We see it as a burden. We see it as a checklist. We see it as a, okay, done, out of the way. If you understand what you're doing, it is the ultimate ego killer. Okay? You're bowing. You're placing your head on dirt. It's mustahab to rub your nose in dirt. All these things, right, are meant to kill the ego. Okay? So the first thing I would do, and I don't know how young this person is who asked this question is, don't underestimate the power of salat. Now, it is the big movement towards meditation, towards yoga, and those are all great things, but they're not meant to replace our salat. Okay? Salat is an entire encompassing mind, body, and soul exercise. It's a worship. And God says, do it 5 times a day. Can you imagine? Imagine doing yoga 5 times a day. Imagine meditating 5 times a day for 5, 10 minutes at a time, right? With complete mindfulness, where would you be? Okay? Now, that's one. Work on that, inshallah. That'll kill your ego. Are there small things the ulama say? And these might sound weird to you. For example, clean the bathroom in your house. I'm serious. Be the guy who cleans the bathroom in your house. That means scrub the toilet. That means take out the garbage. That means, I don't know, those kind of things. If not, you know, fix the shoe area. Okay? Serve and volunteer in the community. You are in charge to make sure the shoes in the shoe area at Bayt al-Asr are put nicely in the shelf. Pick up somebody's shoes and put them in the shelf. That'll humble you right away. Okay? Long-term solutions for ego killers, muhasabah, self-accountability. Stop there and account for yourself. Don't just write it down. Some people have different outlets. Intellectually, in your mind, sit there and ask yourself, what is it that I've done today and why did I mess up? Where were my triggers? And go from there. Okay? So, there are long-term solutions to kill ego. There are short-term, everyday things, right? Do things that will remind you that, look, you're not as high and mighty as you think you are. Okay? Number 4, what is the purpose behind touching alams? Okay, let's do that. Let's talk about this. Anyways, alams, tabuts, jula, all these things. First of all, these questions about these alams and tabuts have only, I believe, recently come about. I grew up in a very typical Indo-Pakistani home in a very, very typical Pakistani Urdu-speaking center my whole life. Okay? I think my first English ashar that I heard was when I was maybe 22 years old. Okay? Now, they've really tamed things down now. I remember in Abu Fazl Abbas's 8th Muharram Majlis, there used to be a train of 15 alams. It's incredible to me that for everything else that right now happens, we understand everything else. When it comes to Islamic concepts, for some reason, we throw a fit. And I'm going to be very, very blunt with all of you. Sometimes I think for people who are in their 20s and people who, I just kind of shake you guys a little bit. Like, everything else out there, they use symbols, right, to remind you of realities. Okay, look, we live in a branding era. Okay, there's brands everywhere. A successful brand is one that you look at that brand and you're reminded of a shoe company, or you're reminded of an athlete. Okay, or you're reminded of some team, let's say, for example. You go into museums and they preserve swords and shields and armor, and they preserve the war flags. They have documentaries on this stuff to tell you what happened in World War I. Okay, this was the armor that was worn by this general in World War I, for example. Okay, and all that's meant to do is, to number one, to preserve the legacy. Number two, to remind you of the history. And number three is to make it real, to actualize it for you. Now, why can't we apply? That all makes sense. We'll pay money to the museum and go see these things. We're like, whoa, that's pretty cool, man. That's pretty cool. Why can't we apply the exact same thing to alams and tabuts and everything else? An alam is nothing but a symbol. In every war, religious, irreligious, they would have flags. They would have standards, because if somebody would see from afar between two fighting armies, they would tell by the flag that they're holding, one represents this, one represents that. Okay. So now when you are holding, for example, the alam of Abul Fazl al-Abbas, it's nothing but a flag. It's nothing but a symbol. It's a reminder that this is, you know, what the alam possibly could look like on the day of Ashura. And when you visualize, because we're very visual people, by the way, right? I mean, it's one thing to, for example, read up on Surah Yusuf and its tafsir and listen to a speech on Surah Yusuf. It's one thing where you watch the movie. It's one thing where you listen to me talk about Nabi Musa for 15 nights. It's one thing where you watch the Prince of Egypt, for example. Okay? What I say you might forget, but the image of watching the sea part on TV in a movie, that won't escape you. Watching the alam now come out of the azakhana now, your mind goes to that moment of Imam Hussein now at the khema, watching the alam from afar go back and forth, up and down. Tabut is nothing but our announcement that had we been there on the day of Ashura, we would have lifted your mayyat on our shoulders. That's our announcement to say, look, Hussein, you would not be left on the plains of Karbala alone. You would not be carrying Ali Akbar's mayat alone. I would be there and I would give kanda. I would give shoulder. Right? I would. Look, think about it. It's actually mustahab to carry a coffin during a funeral. And a lot of us do. I don't know what happens in New Jersey, but in Toronto, we have a huge lineup going from the mosque to the funeral van, and we carry literally past the coffin on our shoulders. And it's recommended to go and to carry the coffin. Number one is that you are supporting the people who are the family. Number two is you're reminded that one day now you'll also be carried like you're carrying this person. It's a reminder. Alams and tabuts are nothing but reminders. Nobody worships these things, guys. Okay, if I am sitting there and I am asking at the alam for a dua, I see that alam as a path of nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I see this alam to represent that man who sacrificed everything for God. I am at the alam, and that is a symbol for me as a representative to somebody called Babul Hawa'ij, the door of your hajat, the door of your du'as. So if an elder woman now, elder man is sitting there and she's crying at the alam with her hands raised, she believes that, look, getting to Allah might be difficult. Let me try going through Abbas to Hussein to the Prophet to Allah. Okay, these are not idols that we worship. These are simple symbols that allow us to actualize azadari in our mind. Now, why do you touch it? That touching is out of respect. That's it. It's out of respect. We see it as muqaddas. We see it as something that's pure. It's a symbol that symbolizes purity. So we treat it like that. Okay? I mean, if you can put a baseball, I tell you, these things are accepted by everybody. But again, when it comes to Azadari, ooh, Qiyamah, why? If you can take Michael Jordan's rookie basketball card and put it in a case, in a vault, don't touch it, don't crease it, make sure it's protected, blah, blah, blah. To you, that's purity. To you, that's very, very valuable. So you're going to put it somewhere else. Some people actually have these, you know, these, in the banks now, they have these lockers. They put their gold in there, they put their jewelry in there, and then they put their valuables. And part of that, of course, sometimes is the baseball that was, I don't know, the last home run of Barry Bonds, for example. That's okay. That's purity. That should be preserved. But if someone goes and kind of puts their hand and says, you know, that's them, that's, look, this is very pure to me. Might be a piece of cloth for you. It represents something more to me. Okay? Something more to me. I hope that makes sense. And so when you talk about idols and shirk, no, of course not. No, nobody is worshiping these things. No one's saying, La ilaha illa alam. There's no God but alam. La ilaha illa tabut. No one's saying that, my brother. Sisters, please. Don't create things. Don't automatically assume that everything that's been going on for centuries is all out. Oh, everything our parents did is wrong. No, they did something right. They have aqidah, they have belief. They came here in a very, very foreign land and established these four walls, something you and I cannot do. Number five. My daughter is the only hijabi girl in school. And even her cousins and most of her Shia friends don't wear hijab. It's very difficult for her to be the only one doing hijab and for us to help her with this stress. Any suggestions? It's a great question, and it's a huge problem. The advice that I would give you is continue to be the voice of support for her. Okay? If that means that you make hijab into an avenue where you reward her, go out, pick out beautiful hijabs, beautiful abayas, make it a whole process, you know, build that certainty of her faith, for example, challenge her to know the deen, that's all you can do. And look, do not underestimate the power of prayer of the parents. Okay? My mothers and fathers who are listening right now, you have an incredible backstage pass to God. You have VIP access to God. He listens to you. You are the parents. Beg Allah, Allah, please. This is my only daughter, and she's the only one in her whole school wearing hijab. Please, you know, let her know. You know, and just a reminder, she doesn't have to be this massive ambassador. If she doesn't have the answers to the question, it's okay. Tell her, you know what, I don't know. I do it because God tells me, and I submit, and that should be enough. Okay, let me keep going here. I'm in my mid-20s and successful in my career and live on my own, but my parents never appreciate my accomplishments and nag me all the time, especially to be a better Muslim and to get married. When I was growing up, they weren't too religious. We did basics of masjid involvement like Ramadan and a few months in Muharram, praying and fasting on and off. In the past few years, my dad became religious. And I did everything right to make them proud with my career and to be financially independent. But now I am being judged by my parents for being Americanized, even though I still do the same Muslim community things we did growing up. I am also not mentally ready to get married. I'm trying to figure myself out. How can I tell my parents to give me space? So it's a good question, and I'm going to address both parties. Number one is, to my parents out there, you have to understand that you're dealing with a different generation. Okay? Call it what you want. Bade hassas bache hain molana. They're very sensitive. They're very this and that. Right? Jaldi ghussa jata hai. They get angry very quickly. Whatever it is, that is the reality. Okay? I don't think we realize, and I say that being born and raised in the West, we don't realize how difficult it is to be a 15-year-old, a 21-year-old in today's society, in America, trying to hold on to their faith. The sheer pressure now to be relevant, to be validated, to be accepted, for others now to sit there and rubber stamp you as a human being is very difficult. To throw yourself out there and wait for someone to accept you or reject you is mind-boggling to me. I don't know how they do it. So, which means if they are different, then our ravish of tarbiyat has to be different. The methodology of which we raise our kids has to be different. Okay? I always hear my elders and my parents say, oh, my father never did this. My father, okay, well, it's a different era, right? Different time. So we have to be careful. Your job, our job as parents, is absolutely to be the authority figure. Lay down the law, set the limits, remind them of God. If you need to be individuals that, you know, be the voice of reason for them. If you need to set limits, if you need to be the authority figure, if you need to discipline them, that's your right as a parent. But what Islam does not give ijazah to is to disrespect the child, is to strip them of their dignity. Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, alayhim as-salam, are entering the house during a hadith of Kisa, assalamu alaykum ya amma, wa alaykum salam ya qurrata ayni, wa thamrata fawadi, wa alaykum salam, oh, the apple of my eye and the fruits of my heart, the light of my heart. Right? Look at the way that Sayyidah Fatima addresses her children. Okay? So, tarbiyat is not to crush your child. It's not to sit there and tell them, look, you know, for some reason, we believe that love, the only avenue of love for my parents today is tough love. If I'm a little bit soft on him, he'll be complacent, Malana. If I'm soft on him, he'll let his guard down. No, sometimes today's kid, doesn't matter if it's 10 years old, 20 years old, 30 years old. Sometimes they need words of encouragement from the parents. Sometimes they need a simple, I'm proud of you. If you can't find the words, invent them. Google it. How do I compliment my child? I'm serious. If you've never been taught that, then change. I'm sorry. Please. Okay, this is not the streets of Hyderabad or Karachi or Lahore or I don't know, Lucknow. I'm sorry. If you're going to migrate to America, you're going to have to ensure that the tarbiyat now is different. And this is not an Americanized tarbiyat. Okay, Islamic tarbiyat is not to sit there and to yell and scream at the child or to destroy them and destroy their dignity. No. Islam very much says that you are to speak to them with a soft tongue. The Prophet says the same way you are asked to respect your parents, your parents are asked to respect you. Now, my parents don't like this conversation when I say this. They think that I'm part of the problem. Oh my God, how many emails do I get? Maulana, you are ruining our children. Maulana, you have completely handcuffed me as a parent. Adib, hey, this is a deen. It's not from me. Okay, we're taking the deen from, you know, our childhood. And I'm sorry, as much as we love our grandparents and their parents and their parents, not everything they did was according to the deen. That's on this side. On our side, as immigrant children to immigrant parents, please understand one thing. Okay, their job is to always be that voice of reason. Okay. You know, we're stuck on tone sometimes. Don't be stuck on tone. Yeah, sometimes it'd be nice if they said it properly. But let's understand, what is it that they're trying to tell you? Look, in the question it says that they are always trying to make me a better Muslim. How dare they? What do you mean? They're trying to make you a better believer and you're complaining about that? Fine, if they're saying, look, did you pray namaz? That's their job. And until their very last breath, they will forever do that. And you should be thankful that you have somebody in your life reminding you of your true purpose and destination. Because they know that people who become successful in their business can very easily sway from the deen. They are your... Sorry. They are your voice of reason. They are your voice of your conscience. Okay? They ensure that your ego doesn't get out of hand. Be thankful for them. I get it. Sometimes their tone is sharp. Sometimes they'll never sit there and say, wow, I'm so proud of you. Do you honestly believe that your parents are not proud of you? If you're looking for words and you may not get them, invent them for you. Let me be the first to tell you I'm proud of you. Hear it from me. If you are somebody who's worked hard in America, in that culture, to be somebody who is successful, I am proud of you. The community is proud of you. And yes, you want to hear specific words from your parents. And sometimes they don't have the words. Imam Ali says, when you are waiting for an apology from your brother or your sister or your loved ones, and they don't give it to you, invent it for them and move on. Heal through that and move on. Okay. In terms of marriage, again, that's a talk that now you and your parents have to have, right? You got to be open to it on both sides. Those days are gone that they can't force you to marry. But yes, the further you get into your marriage, the better it is for you. Remember, you're protecting yourself from sin. Your parents are protecting you from sin. They know that the true life begins after you get married. As a single guy making lots of money, you know, you could end up loving the freedom you think happens when you're single and you are in charge of your own money. They want to make sure that you don't fall into that trap, inshallah. Okay? Everything okay? Any issues so far? We're good. We're halfway through.
Alhamdulillah, we're going okay. Very well. Okay. Thank you.
Trying to plow through these. I'm sorry if I'm going too fast. Our daughter is going to a university away from home. I'm afraid that she will lose her faith completely as she isn't regular in her prayers. She tried hard to convince us to let her go away for school as she feels she needs to become more independent. She's a responsible and hardworking student, but what can we do now as we don't want her to rebel against us if we nag her too much? Yeah, it's a balancing act. It's a case-by-case situation, okay? As I said in the previous question, you should not be made to feel guilty as the parents to be their constant voice of conscience. All right. If to my uni guys out there, if you are out of state, off campus or on campus, and your mom is calling you, and the first question she asks is, "Did you pray namaz?" Oh God, mom, really? That's not a response you give to your mother and your father, who's reminding you to be a close servant of God. Okay. Thank Allah for your parents. Yeah, you want the freedom, blah, blah, blah. They will do what they do best, and that is remind you of God. Okay? And sometimes I tell you, you won't realize it. I didn't realize my father until he left me in my late 20s. And now still, it's been almost 20 years since he passed away. I still now regret. Because, you know, I was like, okay, dad, roll my eyes. Meanwhile, if I look back to it, he was simply trying to make me a better person. So all you can do is be a reminder. God says to the prophet, you are a Bashir, you are a Nadir. You are a warner, you are one who gives good tidings. Warn them of the repercussions. Give them glad tidings of Jannat or heaven or serenity. But ultimate hidayat is up to you. You have made the decision with your husband or your wife that we're going to let our daughter now go away for university. Now trust. Trust the taribit that you gave them. Trust the taribit of the Ahlul Bayt and pray for them, inshallah. But always be that reminder. They can hoo and ha and, you know, roll your eyes and okay, mama. Let them do all that. That's them. But you continue to be their parent. Because it doesn't matter if they're 40 or 50 and you are, mashallah, now a grandparent, you're still their parent. My mother still tells me certain things, right? And I expect her to do that, inshallah. Okay. Now, this question. Maulana keeps mentioning that the youth can take their sweet time in fulfilling their obligations as they wish and should not be told otherwise. What if they run out of time and never get to that stage? Isn't there a sense of urgency relayed to us by our imams regarding fulfilling of our duties? So first of all, I found this question to be insulting. To be very blunt with all of you, I never once said, oh, take your sweet time. Those weren't my words. If you're going to now quote me, then quote me verbatim, word for word, okay? Don't add your mirchi masala, your haldi, your adak lesson. Don't do all that. Don't add your salt and your garlic and your, okay? I never said, oh, take your sweet time. Don't worry. If you don't want to pray namaz, it's okay. Don't pray namaz that day. Don't worry. You are you. Show me anywhere in my ashra where I said that to any of you. So I didn't do that. So I find that insulting, first of all. Let's, you know, if you're going to quote me properly. I'm very careful with my words up here. And everything I'm saying does not come from my empty mind. It comes from the Ahlul Bayt. On top of that, if you heard the entire majlis, you would know that I said that where the red line that you cannot now dip under is your fara'id and your wajibat. I was talking about all the mustahab things that sometimes we make such a bulge on us, a heavy burden on us. I was talking about those things. If at that moment now your heart isn't into it to do your mustahab act, then don't do that. But you cannot sacrifice your wajibat. The fulfillment of your wajibat is prime. It doesn't matter if you have to drag yourself to janamas, or you're not feeling it, or it's like, oh God, you have to do it. I will never say, oh, okay, only pray Fajr on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Baba Manik Kabibullah, tell me one time I said that in any speech. I didn't. Right? The condescending nature of this question is insulting. I'm sorry. Okay? So no. What I'm saying is, I'm telling you that this is a journey to God. Okay? A journey to God. If you were to drive from New Jersey to Los Angeles, drive, right, down, all the way down southwest, it would not be smart now to expect yourself to drive in one shot from New Jersey to LA. You would stop over at a hotel, you would stop over at a rest spot, grab a coffee, fill up for gas, take a little bit of a break, stop for namaz. Okay? But you wouldn't turn around, right? And say, oh, forget it. The journey to God is a journey to God. You have to keep trekking along that journey. Every wajib act that you now perform is you now driving a little bit towards Allah. Every time you're on the road towards LA, that's your wajibat. Every time you pull over and take a break, that's your heart saying, look, all I can handle right now is the wajibat. Oh, there are people who, Surah Mulk and Surah Yasin and Surah Rahman, beautiful things. I'm not saying that. But it's to the point where it becomes a burden now. We're tired. We're checking to see, okay, where is that Surah? Oh my God, there's still three pages. Okay, at that moment, Baba, close the book, put it aside. It's not wajib on you. We don't want to create this nafrat, na'udhu billah, this sort of distaste in my mouth for worship. That's not me, it's Yahabit. The Prophet says to Imam Ali, Ali, this is a vast ocean of adeen. Enter it slowly. No problem. Enter it slowly. So I never once said, take your sweet time. No. Your wajibat are non-negotiable. Non-negotiable. Okay? You can never say, oh, today I don't feel like praying namaz or fasting because Sayyid Asad said, I can take a break from fasting. No, I didn't. I don't have the power to make something halal, haram, haram, halal. I don't have that kind of power. Wajib is wajib ala kulli hal. Okay? For men, there's never a reason you can't pray salat. Even if you're drowning in the ocean, there is salat al-ghalq, the drowning of salat. You're in a war, for example, there's salat al-khawf. Okay? In every sense, you can't stand, for example. All you can do is blink your eye for salat. Okay? That's non-negotiable. If you are a able body, not traveling in the month of Ramadan for no apparent reason, and you don't have any other issues, you are fasting. Don't tell me I'm tired, I want to take a break. I never said that. Never said that. Okay, let's move on. Well, hopefully that's clear. Okay, we're plowing through, inshallah. Let's see what's going on. Okay, we are about 20 minutes left, and I'm getting a little bit. I actually, after 12 days of this marathon, today I woke up with a little bit of a sore throat and a little bit of a cough. It was bound to happen, but alhamdulillah, it happened on the 13th of Muharram and not on the 6th or the 7th, alhamdulillah. So don't mind my voice. Today is my rest day. So, you know, alhamdulillah, inshallah, I'm getting through this. Question now to the introductory discussion. I think this came today, actually. With the predominant culture for a house madras being Urdu-centric, we feel that our 14-year-old daughter can be lost if she attends them, as she will sit there and not be able to relate. We also want to ensure that her current interest continues to grow at this impressionable age, while mindful that taking her to more and more programs may have the risk of becoming disillusioned. Some way as one gets disillusioned with continued adverts with searching. Okay, all right, same way, I'm sorry, okay. How does one strike the right balance to stimulate continued religious development in these teenage years that they find relevant, especially since it is uncool amongst their peers? Great question. Now, I would say that attending an Urdu majlis is not just about the 30, 35 minute Urdu speech, okay? What I mean by that is that even if you take your 14-year-old who does not know Urdu to an Urdu majlis, okay? And they can't get any, they get 1% of the actual Urdu majlis. There's still a lot of things to learn from a majlis that they can benefit from. Okay? And that comes from the idea that you have to explain to your child that the rituals that are there in the Aza, from the Marsiya to the Salam, to the Matam, to the Ziyarat, to the Tabarruk, all of it has an Islamic backing, absolutely. Okay, like for example, if my young guys right now are listening, this idea of a marsiya, okay, that sometimes our youth, you know, they make fun of. So there is one guy reciting, then there's three guys around him, and they begin to recite. Okay, we think, oh, what is this? Blah blah blah. You know, this Urdu poetry. We don't understand that this actually was laid down by the Ahlul Bayt. By the Ahlul Bayt. Every Imam after Imam Hussein would have certain customs when Muharram came about. They would call the poet of their time, ask the poet, write poetry about my grandfather Hussein. Okay? Recite that poetry. Recall the events of what happened. So Imam Sajjad would tell the events of the day of Ashura, and the poets would write about it in their poetry, and then they would recite. Okay? And to the point where the imam would stop them and say, no, recite again, this time put a little bit more grief into it. And the people around them listening would be grieving. And it's not ah, it's high, high. When you say high enough, high, those are people around the Marcia. Okay, it's not some it's not some background band members that are sitting there making sure you're on tune. They're creating an environment of grief. Remember this, guys. You know, sometimes we create environments that are forced to invoke a certain level of happiness. When you walk into a wedding, you see decor, you see balloons, you see flowers, you see people wearing shiny clothing, and that invokes a sense of happiness. It actually forces you to be happy. Okay? And that's part of the process of a wedding. They create an environment for happiness. Why can't we create an environment for grief? You walk into a majlis, there's black on the walls, there's black on your bodies, there are people on stage that are moaning essentially out of grief, and there's a man now who's describing the sacrifice of Karbala. That's all from the imams. Okay? Matam sinezani is organized grief, standing now in line. Again, a poet now, a noha being recited, which essentially is poetry, and you're slapping your chest out of the grief. Now, where the limits are there, the maraji have established those limits, you follow the maraji. Okay, tabarruk is the idea of us giving to those who have come for the azah. Right, it comes from barakah, from birka actually, which means barakat. These are not cultural things that we throw out. Okay, let's be careful. So the idea, even if it's an Urdu majlis, I would still take your 14-year-old, because there's lots of adab and etiquette that you teach her how to dress in a majlis, how to sit in a majlis, how to speak to others, salam, dua. She sees individuals, right? She can see, it softens the heart. Don't underestimate the power of a majlis. Imam Radha alayhi salatu wasalam, man jalasa majlisan yurhiya fihi amruna lam yamut qalbuhu. For the one now who sits in a gathering where our affairs are mentioned, our grief is mentioned, our celebration is mentioned, those are gatherings that enlighten the hearts. People who sit in those gatherings, their heart will never die. Lam yamut qalbuhu. It won't die. Don't underestimate the power of even sitting in a majlis that is not in your language. Hope that makes sense. Now, yes, you want to balance it out with the idea that, about the idea of English majalis in her language, of course. And there's plenty online. I mean, I go through series of lectures of other ulama, sometimes my colleagues, on certain topics, and I make notes. I do. When I'm done reciting a majlis, I go home and I promise myself I listen to one majlis at night before I go to bed. So I have it on my TV, I Chromecast it there, either in Urdu or in English, and I choose. MashaAllah, you have a buffet now, alhamdulillah, of knowledge, of all languages and all ulama, all afkar, all ideologies. Okay, benefit from the ones that you can benefit from, inshallah. Whew, okay. What changes we have to make in our current traditional azadari to engage our youth more and to make the movement of Karbala more relevant to them? We can only attract them if they realize it is solving their important social and personal issues. How can we keep the channel of Pure Islam open to all people in our community without labeling or branding them again as religious, moderate, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The aim is to keep the doors open to everyone, even if someone has 1% chance of getting it back to Salat al-Mustaqim. And I think that we are getting there. I really, really think that we're getting there. This embracing that's happened to an English, the English aspect of Azadari has taken off in the past 10 years. I tell you, as a speaker, you don't understand. Sometimes half of my crowd in the English language are elders. Elders who are from the Indo-Pak continent. Elders who prefer, whose mother language is Urdu. Okay, those days now where people would complain about English majalis are no longer there. A lot of you would sit there, and 10 days are very, very precious to all of you. You know, they're the most important days of the year for you. And I see a lot of parents sacrifice that to make sure they go to an English majlis and listen to a speaker that is much younger than them, also so the message can get to the proper channels. I think that it's happening. There's poetry being made, there's documentary being made. We have all sorts of Shia channels in English that are right now producing excellent content for Azadari. I think all of it's being done. All you have to do is balance it out. Do not be stuck on one language. Don't think that Azadari is only Urdu or only English. No, every language. every language now can present Azadari, right? This is not anyone's Hussein, this is everyone's Hussein. Remember that. This is not anyone's Hussein, it's everyone's Hussein. Okay? So I think that it's being done. I think that, you know, this chance you're giving... I'm sorry. Give me a second here, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Thank you. This chance that we're giving these youth, I see Bait al-Asr's videos afterwards, mashallah, you know, from Hamza to others, to Mutahhir Bhai's son, to mashallah, to so many other individuals, right? Even at Bait al-Qaim now, I see so many. This is you now injecting that into them. And don't think for a moment it's not having impact. It is. It is. The questions I get from seven-year-olds, like they ask me, you know, who is Shahzadi in Karbala? Okay, who's the one that tied Imam Hussein's, Imam Sajjad's arms together? Right? Was it a horse or a camel? I mean, incredible questions. I never asked those questions at 7 years old. Never. I just kind of assumed. Right? So we have to be able to be those individuals that understand that there are things that are working. Yes, yes. Okay. Let's go back to the WhatsApp group. Mutahhir Bhai, you sent some more questions?
Just a last question, Maran. I just sent you right now. Sorry, it's a little long, but this will be a last question.
There was one about mental health I saw somewhere. I wanted to... yes, okay. Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, I didn't get that one. Okay, so I'm looking at the one that you're sending me privately, but I'm going to go into the WhatsApp group. There is one that I wanted to address and maybe make this, if it's okay, the last question. We'll see how it goes.
Sure.
The question on the discussion of mental health. It's a very good question. I love it. While those from the previous generations may be taking longer to embrace the reality of mental health, I sometimes wonder if their challenge has merit because their perspective is the struggle they went through to be successful. Surely what they endured was not good for their mental health. However, they powered through out of no option. And they therefore have difficulty navigating the challenges that that youth are going through today, which to them originates from ease equals value. Beautiful. If I can be challenging and on the side of the elders for a minute, based on the above, is this mental health business a first world problem? I mean, how can we even begin having a discussion on mental health with the youth of Palestine and oppressed elsewhere? I agree. Also, how do we ensure that we are not trapped into being overly cautious of mental health issues and thereby not stretching our kids to the max for their development? So it's a great question. And you're right. It is a balance. And a balance that I think we're still trying to figure out. There are those that believe that, and I'm one of them, that we cannot compare this childhood and this upbringing to, like I said, even me growing up in the 90s as a teenager. Is nothing compared to what they face today. Take it all the way back to Karachi or Hyderabad, wherever you're from, let's say, for example, or other countries in Iraq or Iran, Afghanistan, possibly. You're right. Those stressful, those anxious moments also happened in your generation when you were younger and there was no outlet, no compassion. You know, I joke that, you know, I often would wonder what would happen if my father told his father at 15 that, "Dad, I feel stress in Karachi." You'd get laughed at. There was no acceptance of those emotions, but that's not the way you do things. And we think for a second that, oh, we were okay. We were successful. I think that's also a very broad conclusion. There are some of our elders who are jaded, who are angry, who did not succeed, who had heart attacks at 40, who dropped at 51, for example, right? And that's an element of, You could say bad diet, smokers. It's also an element of stress management. Okay. So you said it yourself that you know, it was challenging. And absolutely, right? Even with this advent and arrival of mental health today, the youth are still being challenged to navigate through their stress. All we're doing is we're giving them a little bit of extra strength, but the boost comes from them. Do I think that sometimes we coddle? Yes. I do. I think sometimes they need to be uncomfortable. And that's the spot that I think they're not at. They're afraid to be with their emotions, with their ups. And I talk about ease equals value all the time. The moment the marriage gets a little bit difficult, divorce. the moment the course is hard, drop it. If this job is stressing you out, for example, and the hours are too early, quit the job, right? Because they don't have this mentality of a hoarder's mentality. My elders, my parents in the audience, whatever they got and they hung on to. Okay. If their tape recorder broke, they would tape it, they would wire it, they would elastic band, because they're not guaranteed I can go out and buy a different tape recorder. They were just in survival mode. So they had no choice, but our youth are not in survival mode right now. Okay. Sometimes we upgrade our phones for no apparent reason. My iPhone 6 is perfectly fine, but I want the 12 Max Pro because I can. Now come, some could say, oh, that's asraf. Fine. But they're not thinking in survival mode. They're thinking in value mode, okay? We have to now combat that with the deen and say, look, the deen says, be simple. At the same time, it does say self-actualize. Maslow's theory, Abraham Maslow's theory, that triangle, you know, the bottom is just food and shelter. And for many, many years, our parents were just about, look, I just need to feed you and make sure you have a home. So you would work odd jobs. This generation right now, the ones who are earning money in their 20s and 30s are not worried about dwelling, not worried about their next meal. In America, I don't think they are. They are trying to get to that peak of the triangle being self-actualization. What they don't realize is they have to travel through themselves to get there. So they're trying to get there by avoiding themselves. You can't. You can't. There's trauma inside of you. There's triggers inside of you. There's sin. There's envy, greed. There's lust, desire inside of you that has to be navigated. وَعَسَىٰ أَن تَقْرُهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ The Quran says, it could be that you despise something. It's actually very, very good for you. It's a beautiful question. It's an ongoing process. And I think we're all trying to figure out the balance between coddling our generation and allowing them to flourish. I think a little bit of a dakka, a little bit of support that we have you, a little bit of a safe net is okay, provided they're not afraid to climb, right? And you know, we have yet to figure out that balance, if you ask me. I think that seeing this young divorce rate that's going on is devastating for me. These are couples who are fighting to get married, you know, taking on the entire family to get married, the whole world to get married. And within 70 days, they're divorcing because they can't handle the idea of it being uncomfortable. It's not easy, so it's not valuable. I totally agree. Totally agree. Great question, by the way. Beautiful. Let's do one more, if you don't mind, Mutahar Bhai.
Sure.
Okay. So this university and on their own and this and that, I think I've touched that already. Changes to Azadari, I've touched that, inshallah. The question by Dr. Musa is a good one. And I've never seen it in that light, right? Allah helped the Muslims in the Battle of Badr, and why his help didn't come in Karbala. Great question. So we are talking about something that is about almost 60 years of a difference. Okay. So Badr happened in the second year of Hijri, I believe, second or third, and then of course Karbala in 61st, right? So about late 50s, 60s. So the state of the Muslims was a little bit different. They were very fragile in Badr. They needed a little bit of encouragement. Okay, they were very, very, you know, they were at a moment where they weren't sure. Also, that's number one. Okay, whereas you know, and that was a war against a kuffar. This is a domestic, a civil war, unfortunately, between you know Imam Hussein and so-called Muslims on that side. That's number one. So, you know, an apples to apples comparison cannot be made because, you know, we're talking about, you know, 5 decades later, Islam was a little bit more pukhta, a little bit more solid in its foundation. The Muslims were now a little bit more concrete and firm into their belief, number one. Number two is that the purpose of the wars were different. Imam Hussein was not there to actually fight. He was there now to relay a process. The process had to go through its term. It had to go through its fulfillment. Imam Hussein had to be sacrificed. Abul Fazl Abbas had to be sacrificed. In order to awaken the masses, the blood of the grandson of the Holy Prophet had to be shed. Otherwise, everything else, nothing else would have mattered. There had to be, and for lack of a better word, a little bit of a shock value to really kind of, you know, unveil the reality of Yazid and present the truth of the Ahlul Bayt. So for these two reasons now, the angels didn't come. And mind you, they were presented to Imam Hussein. We actually believe animals came, angels came. We believe that Jibreel came on the day of Ashura, army of thousands of angels, and Imam Hussein said no. Right? So we trust the ilm of the Hujjat of Allah, that at that moment, this isn't about me defeating that army, it's about the sacrifice that need to be made. That's a great question. We will end there. I cannot tell you how amazing these questions are. And again, as I said in the month of Ramadan, it really shows the level of the community. I'm thankful for everybody, Mutahhir Bhai, his entire team. I know there's a lot of people, Musa Bhai and AV, Hamza and AV, individuals that are behind the scenes. Mutahhir Bhai is, mashallah, the handsome face on camera. There are many people behind the camera that we cannot see. And again, for these questions now, may Allah bless you all. It's a struggle. It's a fight. I'm with you. I'm on the ground right beside you. And inshallah, I'll pray for you and you pray for me. And my only dua is that the Imam of our time is pleased with all of you, inshallah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Maulana, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. On behalf of the entire Bayt Waliyullah, sir, organizers and the community, I'd like to thank you for the great topic and great lectures. It was so relevant. And everyone getting so many messages from everywhere. How relevant it is, inshallah. But I do have two private messages by two community members I would like to share with you. First one from Dr. Muswi. I would like to express my gratitude on behalf of the entire Bayt Waliyullah Asad community to Maulana Asad Jafri for his wonderful enlightening lectures. While referring to the 11th Muharram Majlis, Maulana has been an amazing realtor for our one-bedroom apartment, helping us get to the right master or owner or occupant.
Very well said. Beautiful said. Yeah.
And I also would like to thank...
I'm gonna use that example, Dr. Musfi, just so you know. I'm going to steal it.
And then he's thanking Bayt Waliyullah organizers for having you all the time. And we had you in Ramzan. And there seems like there's a connection we are building up here with you, Maulana. And it looks like they're all looking forward for more programs with you. Inshallah, we'll talk about next Ramzan.
Inshallah.
And then
I like how you put that in there. Yeah, okay.
Squeeze that in there somewhere. And then also, there's a brother who asked a question. He's apologizing for the confusion. He didn't mean to do that or hurt your feeling in any ways. It was just written in haste, he said, but intention was just to clarify for myself. Really enjoyed your speeches and learned a lot from it.
I love you all. Thank you very much for that. Thank you.
Thank
I
you.
Also want to say, I want to thank Dr. Musa Jafri as well. Every time I speak at Bayt Al-Asr, he makes it a point to send me a private message of encouragement. Whenever I go and visit Bayt Al-Asr, I have the honor of meeting him, and every meeting with him, I learned something. So, Dr. Musa, I appreciate your encouragement and your hosla afzai. May Allah give you a long life, inshallah. Hassan, thank you.
Thank you.